Paul as an apostle, 1 Corinthians 9. Last time we talked about idols and meat sacrifice to idols in chapter 8, and that just, it seems like a non-issue to us. What I tried to emphasize is that we have some other issues that are at least analogous, where they're not moral issues in the sense that the scripture doesn't say you can or can't, but some people believe you can't. And there's both some teaching about what they should say. They're the ones Paul calls weak in faith. What can they do? Should they judge those who exercise liberty and do those things? How do I treat those who are weak in faith, who, whether it's they think they can't eat shrimp or they think that to have a tattoo is just a terrible sin or whatever. How do we interact with them? In verse 9 or chapter 9, Paul wants to kind of defend his apostleship, but he will come back in what I think is one of the most important passages in the book, and he'll talk about how he becomes essentially all things for all people to reach more people. We'll try to get there. That matters because we all want to grow as a church. I've never been to a church that said they don't want to grow. Well, they said it, but not quite that way.
Yeah.
I was in a meeting with in a church where I was a guest teacher, so I kept my mouth shut. But deacon's wife said, "We don't want those kind of people in our church." I could hear the hammer falling. So maybe we don't always want to grow. But when we don't want to grow, it's because we'd like to grow so long as everybody's made in my image. But people aren't made in my image. They're made in God's image. And if we grow, we're going to change. And so there's some things that we like the way it's done, and it's going to change. Or we won't grow. I mean, those are the choices. I still listen to 8-tracks, and I listen to Edison disc. No one else does, hardly. I rarely run into somebody that listens to 8-tracks. I think they're better, but I probably won't convince you of that. If we don't allow any change, we'll never grow. And so Paul's going to kind of talk about that. But first, he has to defend himself, and it's unfortunate he has to. In 2 Corinthians, he defends himself at even more length, so it's a problem, and it kind of chases him around. He has his critics. He opens, he says, "Am I not free?" Now, that's in the context of having just talked about the liberty to do certain things, particularly with regard to food, with regard to dietary requirements. He's got liberty. Am I not free? Am I not an apostle? Have I not seen have I not seen Jesus our Lord? When did he see Jesus?
On the road.
Yeah, on the road to Damascus, right? And then this gets missed a lot of times, but there's a lot of biographical content in Galatians. And Paul says very clear in Galatians 2, when he became a Christian, he didn't go to Jerusalem so Peter and James and John could school him. He went to Arabia. And it seems like he had direct revelation from Christ. So he's very clear, my gospel came directly from Jesus to him. So I think he even saw him again or heard him or whatever. There's a requirement that apostles have seen Christ. You see that in Acts 1. So anyway, he has seen him. Are you not my work in the Lord? You know, you as a church in Corinth, you're my work in the Lord. These are rhetorical questions. Of course, the answer is yes. If I'm not an apostle to others, at least I am to you, because you are the seal of my apostleship in the Lord. They're sort of the fruit of his labor. My defense to those who examine me is this. See, he's been criticized. He's dealing with criticisms that maybe he heard about it. Maybe it was that letter from Chloe's house that asked the question about the idols and all that. But here's my answer. He says, don't we have the right to eat and drink? There are people coming in there or people among the group who are saying that you don't. And that happens today. I probably have mentioned this before, but like I had gotten reached out for someone who was in a Bible study I taught, I mean, a long, like 20 years ago. And she went to the church and she's there with her husband. And the preacher called her out and said, because you eat pork, you're going to hell. That's a growing movement that's current, where, among other things, they would place those dietary requirements on people as a requirement for salvation. So I'm just saying that those people around then, we don't have as much of that now, but we have it. And he says, don't I have the right to eat and drink? What would he drink? Lemonade? Do you think someone's in there saying, Paul doesn't have the right to drink water?
Heaven forbid they have raisin cakes.
Yeah. What was he drinking?
The wine.
Yeah, he's drinking wine.
To be so godlike, they didn't need food.
Well, he eats and drinks what he wants. And it's interesting in Galatians 2, he talks about how they're all there eating with the Gentiles in Antioch. And Peter's there eating with the Gentiles, and it doesn't say it explicitly. Can you imagine Peter having a ham sandwich in his mouth? And then some Jews come from Jerusalem, and they see him, and he separates from the Gentiles. The implication of eating with the Gentiles is probably eating their food, but he separates from them, and Paul says, I withstood him to his face. So this, I'm just saying, it's a big first century issue. What we have to do sometimes is bridge the gap to kind of applying it, because, yeah, there are some narrow circles where you're going to have someone say you can't. I've had people tell me I can only eat veggies, and they believe strongly about that you can only eat veggies because, you know, you killing animals is wrong and all that. But it's pretty limited. So and I'm just saying, this is kind of a narrow issue, but we have to make an extension. But Paul says, don't we have the right to eat and drink? Eat what you want, drink what you want. Now, he doesn't say anything about gluttony. He's not talking about being drunk. Don't we have the right to be accompanied by a believing wife like the other apostles, the Lord's brothers, or Cephas? Who are the Lord's brothers?
James?
Judas? We call him Jude because we don't want to call him Judas, but his name is Judas. Right? And he has other brothers. He has at least six siblings. He's got at least two sisters. And he names them in only one of the Gospels names them. I want to say it's John's Gospel, but I may be wrong on that. But anyway, they're in Jerusalem. They become early church leaders. And, of course, Peter, Cephas is Peter. He's married. You know, Paul says, you know, I have that right. He was talking about freedom to marry or not to marry in chapter 7. I have that right. I mean, he has exercised it. As far as we know, he wasn't married. Or do only Barnabas and I have no right to refrain from working? Now, what's that about? He's talking about getting paid. The apostles, probably, most of them, you know, in Jerusalem, at least early on, are being, you know, paid in some way, compensated so that they can give all their attention to the church. And he says, don't I have that right? And the answer, of course, rhetorically, should be yeah. But who serves as a soldier at his own expense? Well, nobody. I mean, World War II, you at least got your $21 a month.
That doesn't mean that I have the right to work to make myself wealthy.
No.
It means I have the right to work to get paid for what I do at work.
Including the gospel ministry, right? And that's what he's getting at. If you're in the ministry, I mean, this is dealt with in several places in the New Testament. In Galatians 6 is another one that deals with it. Pay the preacher, basically. And there's a basis for it. Now, what he's going to go on and say is, but I didn't take any money.
Yeah, it wasn't a burden to you.
But I had the right to. And that's his point. And I would say it is biblical to pay the preacher so that he can devote themselves to church task. And I mean, even, you know, I mean, just I'm going to preach today because Mel's out. I mean, even just my quick sermons take 10 or 15 hours.
Yeah, you spend all this time, your time to be reimbursed.
I mean, that's, you have to live. Yeah.
Well, and I would argue at a rate comparable to the average of the church. Personally, but I won't try to defend that now. But just, we get the idea. He says, you know, who plants a vineyard and does not eat its fruit? Or who shepherds a flock and does not drink the milk from the flock, right? You have the right to be paid for your gospel ministry. Am I saying this from a human perspective, he asks? Doesn't the law also say it? And of course it does. And, you know, in the law it says, don't muzzle an ox while it treads out the grain. When the ox is working, he gets to eat some of the grain because the ox has to eat, otherwise it's not going to work. But Paul says he isn't just talking about animals, he's talking about people. Is God really concerned about oxen? Isn't he really saying it for our sake? Yes, this was written for our sake, because he who plows ought to plow in hope. And he who threshes should thresh in hope of sharing the crop. And in the ministry, it's an analogy, right? In the ministry, there will be compensation for him. That can be abused, obviously, but it can be abused in two ways. One where some guy's in it for the money and gets a disproportionate amount of pay. I've mentioned before, you know, I went to lunch with a preacher and his Bentley and that sort of thing. But often it's abused in the opposite way, when people think we need to keep the preacher poor. And I'm like, yeah, I don't want to answer for that in front of Jesus. Not a good thing. So now in a poor church, and I like, you know, I know a preacher in Burundi. I don't expect him to make much money, right? You're talking about people that are making dollar a month.
It's relative.
It's relative to where you're at, right? And I know a missionary in Panama, and you know he's not going to get very much money what he's doing. But we're not there. We're in Chapel Hill, you know. And I'm just saying it's different. So don't you know that those who perform the temple services eat the food from the temple? He says. So it's kind of that same thing. You understand when they sacrifice the animals, they didn't burn the whole animal up and throw it in the trash, right? I mean, they barbecued the animal and ate it. There were pieces cut away, the best pieces, the fat and all that, for God, and burned. And then there were pieces that the people ate, including the priest. You know, you had other offerings like flour offerings, grain offerings. What was that for? So they can make bread. In the same way, the Lord has commanded that those who preach the gospel should earn their living by the gospel. And that's the principle. And there's times when it can only be by vocational because of where you're at or because the church is so small. We found this has become a problem I've seen on the mission field. And I'm just thinking of a church as an example. It's a church in Germany, and they run over 100 people, and they can't support their pastor. And that pastor was continuing to ask the churches here to pay to cover his salary. And my pastor at the time really took a strong view. Look, you've formed as a church like 20 years ago, and we're going to cut you off. People need to give. And it would just so against the German psyche, he would explain to us, to give enough money to pay the pastor that they wouldn't do it. And so you can see, but that's a problem, especially in Germany because they got money, right? It's not like that was an issue. So he should be paid for his gospel. For my part, I've used none of these rights. So he didn't take a dime from them. This allows him not to have anyone who could say he's in it for the money, but that wouldn't keep him from doing it. And I think that's why he wants to point it out. Paul's motives get called to question, and he points out, I haven't exercised these rights. I am entitled to be paid for my ministry, and I haven't. Nor have I written these things that they may be applied in my case. He's not writing so that he will get them to start paying. He's not trying to change the circumstance. He's reminding them that they really don't have a basis for anybody to question his motives. For it would be better for me to die than for anyone to deprive me of my boast that, what, he worked for free and can't be impugned on his motives. For if I preach the gospel, I have no reason to boast, but I am compelled to preach. Woe to me if I don't preach the gospel. For if I do this willingly, I have a reward. He's talking about in heaven, not from getting a paycheck. But if unwillingly, I'm still entrusted with this commission. God met him at the Damascus Road and said, you're going to go preach. What then is my reward? To preach the gospel and offer it free of charge and not make full use of my rights in the gospel. Now, this doesn't mean he didn't have a right to. I mean, he could have. He chose not to. It sort of protected his being beyond reproach. He says, although I am free, and this is the part I wanted to get to, it's just so critical for us. Although I'm free from all and not anyone's slave, he doesn't owe them anything. He has this liberty he's been talking about. He says, I've made myself a slave to everyone in order to win more people. That's the part we don't want. We don't really want to change to reach people. It's just my opinion. We want to reach people who already kind of look like us, so they'll fit in good. And that's just a problem we have. We face it. And we organize churches around what really, in a sense, are preferences. But like you can have an all-Chinese church, for example. I know in where I live, there was an all-Romanian church. It's odd. There were just enough Romanians in that area to have an all-Romanian church. But you can have churches around other just commonalities. And the church I came from, I would never get in the pulpit without a coat and tie. People just dress different. You'd have a few people dress casual. Most wouldn't. But I would never be in the pulpit without a coat and tie. I would never gotten in the pulpit with shirt tucked out. I'm just telling you. Is that a moral thing? Is that a sin? Sin not to go to church in a coat and tie? Yeah. Cool. Now, is it wrong to go to church in a coat and tie? No. It's a matter of liberty. But you see, I will tell you, there's a lot of folks, and this is kind of going away, kind of dying out, but a lot of folks, they think it's a real problem to show up without a coat and tie.
Get dressed for church. I've done this myself. you feel like you're honoring God if you go to the trouble getting dressed.
Yeah, no, I totally agree, and that's the argument that some people would make, and I think if that's in their heart, I think it's good, and that's exactly what Paul was saying about that liberty issue in the last chapter. If you don't eat bacon because you believe it honors God, and that's the genuineness in your heart, then you shouldn't eat the bacon, and you should wear the coat and tie. What's happened is culture changes. We just don't like that. It changes. Now, some of it's a moral issue, and I'm not saying we change to match the things that have been, you know, where morals or immorals become moral. But most people, even in professional offices, don't have to wear a coat and tie anymore, or they rarely do. I haven't had to wear a coat and tie in an office for over a decade. I can. I do if I'm going to be, you know, if go to court, that's different. But you know what I'm saying? All I'm saying, it's an area of liberty, but some people would think more highly of it. And you've got Paul here saying, you know, but I'm free. And but what I'm suggesting is this, though. Paul was willing to change in these areas of liberty as an accommodation to people to reach them. And we have to be willing to do it. And we don't like it. All right? In my car, when I'm in control, you're going to hear Elvis Presley. You're going to hear Roy Orbison. You're going to hear Sam Cooke. When my kids are in the car, you're going to hear Hamilton. It's a musical. It's a modern musical supposedly based on Alexander Hamilton. You're going to hear In the Heights. I mean, you know, what am I doing? My connection with my kids, as long as the music's not inappropriate, is music I don't want to listen to. Okay, now sometimes I get them back and I play Dolly Parton, but you know, I'm just telling you, if we're not willing to change, and a lot of us, even though we'll say we are, we're really not, we just don't like it different, you know, we're going to have problems. So look what he says, you know, I'm free and I'm not anyone's slave, but I've made myself a slave to others, to everyone, in order to win more people, which is an aside, totally debunks Calvinism in one verse. The idea that God selected before the foundation of the world those he would save, he passed over everyone else. This is one of the many times Paul says something you really can't make consistent. If you think God picked those he would save before creation and passed over everyone else, then those people are getting saved no matter what Paul does. It doesn't matter if he eats bacon or doesn't eat bacon, wears a coat or doesn't wear a coat. But he says... No, it'd be Calvinism.
That'd be hyper-Calvinism.
Nope.
Which part are you speaking of?
Total depravity and the unconditional election.
You're talking about unconditional election.
Well, trust me, I've read way too much on this.
Well, no, I'm talking about
it. I will say a lot of folks, and we can talk about it, a lot of folks will label Calvinism, they'll call it hyper-Calvinism when it's really not. But hyper-Calvinism was my grandfather, and I'll mention that because it relates to this context, my great-grandfather. Their outreach program was unlocking the doors of the church when they were there on Sunday. Because you do not preach the gospel. After all, they're elect or they're not, and they'll come. And in Baptist circles, it was called being hard-shell Baptist. It's something we don't hear that much anymore, primitive Baptist. But Paul here says something drastically different. He says he changes to accommodate people in order to win more. And, of course, my point on the elect thing is you can't win more if it's a finite set of people that's been preselected. So just ponder that. As you read the scriptures, you see a lot of things, if you'll think about it, that you may have some things back here that you believe, but you got to say, is it consistent? Because somehow I got to wire this all together.
What is being made complicated?
because in the 400s Gnosticism was very popular, and it got brought into Calvinism or brought into Christianity by a guy named Augustine. But that is a talk for another day. Yeah. To the Jews, I became like a Jew. What does that mean? He didn't eat the bacon when he was with them. He did the hand washings. Okay, he probably went to a synagogue. Read Acts 13. He went to a synagogue and he preached there. He became like a Jew, and there are things he could have done, as you know, with Gentiles that would offend them, and he would withstand. He would not do that. He's willing to do that, and of course, he grew up that way. It wasn't hard. He knew these things. He knew he had liberty to do different, but he became as a Jew. But then to those under the law, like one under the law, though I myself am not under the law. Now, what's he talking about there? He's talking about anyone who would consider themselves, even particularly as a Christian, to have to continue to keep aspects of the law. So he's able to deal with these people. He talked about, you know, this weak in the faith stuff in the last chapter. But you can't push people away when God's working in their lives if you can make some accommodation. He says to win those under the law, to win them. And so, you know, it's very cultural. If your first step to try to evangelize someone is to try to get them to not keep the law when they've done that their whole life, you're not going to win them, no matter what you do.
I have a problem with the Jews. I mean, they had all these rules for generations, and now you're telling them, no, that's all wrong. Now it's this one.
Not saying it's all wrong. But what Paul will clearly say, like in Romans 3, is we're no longer under the law, but he's ministering to people who believe they are, and therefore he has to deal with that, and he's not trying to offend them. I think I said this before. You know, you can use the truth. I mean, just because you know the truth doesn't mean you have to say it at that moment. Or say it in a certain way. Does that make sense?
It's persuasive over time. I think it can lead people to change knowing the truth. So that they realize that the law is not necessarily needed.
Yeah.
It looks to me like technology is impinging on some of this. I mean, if you stand up in front of a microphone, you're a TV evangelist. You start preaching these narrow lines like he does for particular groups. You miss all these other people.
That's probably right.
The larger your audience, the more flexible than you would have to be to appeal to all these folks out there listening. Instead of just in these narrow groups, so he's referring to.
No, that's right. And usually we're in an audience, primarily in church, of people who are already believers. And he's got in mind here how to reach unbelievers, but that's exactly right. As your audience gets bigger, it's more hard. I mean, I do a discipleship class on Saturday mornings. Everyone there is in seminary. Most of them are already pastoring a church. It's a different audience than it is even here, and certainly a different audience that I've only occasionally done this, but like when I did Awana for seventh graders, totally different, right? It does become harder. Well, he says, you know, to those who are without the law, like one without the law, and that's probably going to be our Gentiles, though I am not without God's law, but under the law of Christ, and he views that as different. It's not completely unrelated, but it's different. To win those without the law. And that's his goal. He wants to win everybody. And if they're under the law, it's primarily going to be a Jewish person, he wants to win them. And if they're not under the law, they're Gentile, he wants to win them. He typically preached at the synagogue, and then he went and preached to the Gentiles. And you get a good comparison. You read Acts 13, then Acts 17, preaching in a synagogue, preaching to Gentiles. To the weak, I became weak. What are they? They have an issue that's not really a moral issue, but they think it is, like the meat sacrificed to idols. And so he won't eat any meat sacrificed from idols. He even said in that chapter, if he has to go meatless, vegetarian, he will. Why? In order to win the weak, I become all things to all people. None of this has to do with sinning. It has to do with things that are amoral. They are things that you can do or not do. They are things people often think are moral issues. And he's just saying, you know, I will change to accommodate. You know, Titus, Paul never had him get circumcised. He was reading, he says it. It says it in Galatians. But Timothy, he had circumcised. Why? Why the difference? And Timothy was an adult. He was all grown up. His mother was Jewish. His father wasn't. So he didn't get circumcised as a child, as a baby on the eighth day like he should have been. Why does Paul have one circumcised and the other not? Well, who are they ministering to? Titus is ministering to Gentiles primarily. And Timothy, his mother's Jewish, and so a Jewish person would consider him Jewish. And so as soon as he ministers to a Jewish person because of his mother, the fact that he's known not to be circumcised is just a deal breaker, and he's not. So it's an accommodation, though. It's not morally required. It is an accommodation. That's commitment, right? But you understand. I mean, we're willing to make some change to reach some people. He says, "Now I do all this because of the gospel, that I might share in the blessings." So, you know, he sums this up. Don't you know that runners in a stadium all race? I mentioned in the very first week how these people love the games, and a short distance from Corinth is where they had some games that are more or less like a smaller version of the Olympics. And they run and they get a crown. The crown is a Stephanos in Greek. It's made out of kind of vegetation wrapped around your head. And they know, he's using imagery they know. They're like us. They like to watch sports. They don't have TV, so they go to the coast. They watch the games there. Do you know that runners in a stadium all race, but only one receives the prize? Run in such a way as to win the prize. One of my professors years ago, in fact, my mentor, he always told us, run to win, run to win. Talk about the Christian life. You run to win. Well, how are you going to run to win? You're going to change to win more people with the gospel. You're willing to make some changes, and if you have to listen to Hamilton instead of Elvis Presley, you'll suffer it for a while. Okay, if you have to listen to some modern Christian music, you're not going to say, well, God, I'd rather they go to hell than me have to listen to some modern music. I just want to read out of the hymnal. I love the hymnal. I can't read out of it. The words are too small. People have weird ideas. I have my preference, but...
it's a form of inconvenience but and selfishness, it seems like, to that person, you know?
The older folks exist, of course, to glorify God, and we're going to do that best by having a mindset about that next generation. We're trying to build this church for that next group of people. And we have to have that mindset. And the part that I don't like, and no one likes, is things change, and it's not the gospel message and all that, but I'm just talking about external things. And we have to be careful, and we have to get this mindset of Paul that I'll do all this because of the gospel, because I want to share in the blessings. Run in a way to win the prize. Everyone who competes exercises self-control in everything. I can eat shrimp or not eat shrimp, have liquor or not have liquor. Wear a coat. If I go preach at my church I used to go to, I will wear a coat, a tie. It doesn't bother me at all. It's an area of liberty. But they'll tune me out if I show up in a more casual way. Just is. So we'll do it. They do it to receive a perishable crown. That's the Stephanos, not an imperishable crown. That's something permanent. Crowns are symbolic of the rewards. We talked about that in chapter 3. Paul says probably more in this book about rewards than any of them, but rewards are dealt with in every book, and it's rewarding faithfulness. It's not getting punished for your sins. It's not purgatory, but a crown. And so I do not run like one who runs aimlessly or box like beating the air. That's, shadow boxing. Boxing was a sport then, right? He said he's using that as the image. I'm not beating the air. Instead, I discipline my body and bring it under strict control so that after preaching to others, I might not be disqualified. A strong statement. He wants to live what he preaches. He preaches liberty, and he preaches that you'll make an accommodation for people because that's how you love some people. And he is willing to do that, and he doesn't want to be called out as a hypocrite. So that... I hope that makes some sense.
You're saying he doesn't want to be one who condemns?
For non-moral things. And the other thing, too, remember when we're talking about reaching unsaved people, my message to them isn't to get their life cleaned up. You don't find any time Jesus had an evangelistic encounter when he told them, you need to get your life straightened out so I can save you. That woman at the well that was married 5 times and shacked up with the 6th guy, he doesn't even tell her to stop doing it. He doesn't say you can't live with him anymore. That's an issue, but his issue that day, you can't clean your fish before you catch them. I mean, his issue was reaching people. So we have a moral issue. We have a moral voice that we need to have as Christians, but we do need to be careful that we're not seen, and we often are perceived as just people with some do-nots. That's who we are, some do-nots. And it's not who we are.
Is that like those street preachers that stand out there with those signs, they're pretty aggressive, they're telling them, you need to come to know Christ or you're going to,
is true, but...
Well, it is, but is that the way to approach people? The question.
Well, it's not effective. Christianity is the pinnacle of freedom. Freedom is only enjoyed when it's ordered freedom, right? Order... Without liberty, we call totalitarianism. Liberty without order, we call anarchy. God established governance over Israel in the middle. And remember this, they agreed to it in Exodus. They said, yes, we agree to it. It was always governed by consent. And so the idea that Christianity isn't liberty is wrong, but we have that perception. Let's just be mindful what they see.